University of Georgia Griffin campus invites you to join us for news and information about the many and varied programs and activities at the UGA Griffin campus. Information about gardening, the agriculture programs, and your UGA degree at the University of Georgia Griffin campus. Your UGA degree is closer than you think. This program is made possible by Frank and Carolyn Harris of Round Oak Resources Tree Farm and Murray & Company Realtors. Listen each Thursday at 9 o'clock a.m. for the UGA Griffin Campus News. This program is produced by WKEU AM 1450 and 102.3 FM and The Rock 88.9 FM and streamed live on our website, WKEUradio.com. Join us now with our guests from the UGA Griffin Campus.
And good morning and welcome to this morning's installment of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. I'm Tony Brasky, the host of this morning's proceedings, and we are joined once again remotely by Bob Westerfield, Extension Horticulturalist and Coordinator on the University of Georgia campus for the Extension program throughout the state. Bob, welcome back to the program and thanks for joining us today.
Well, good morning, Tony, and it's my pleasure to be back again.
Well, you know, we've got fall weather really starting to try to kick in. Summertime's trying to hold on just a little bit longer over the course of the last week or so and maybe for the next couple of days, but that cool down is coming, and that's going to have a radical effect on plants and gardening and vegetable gardening, plant gardening, you name it. Things are about to change around here, but let's start with this, Bob. Halloween's just around the corner, and we talked about this a little bit the last time you were able to join us, but people have bought pumpkins to decorate the landscape and the porches and whatnot. How hard is it for somebody to grow their own pumpkin? I know, you know, the window on growing your own for this year has come and gone, but how difficult of a process is that, and what considerations do people need to take into mind when they want to try to grow their own?
Well, you know, you said it correctly. It's way too late right now, obviously. You probably have to go buy a pumpkin if you haven't planted one, but it's really not that difficult. Probably the biggest obstacle in growing pumpkins is having the space. It is not a small plant by any means, and it can spread out easily 10, 15, sometimes 20 feet in diameter when that plant kind of, it's almost like an octopus the way it extends out. But that being said, if you've got, you know, a good space, you can certainly do it. The time to plant pumpkins, if you're wanting to have one kind of for the Halloween season, the time to plant them are normally late May to June, depending on the variety. You sort of have to look at the maturity dates, which can kind of fluctuate a little bit. But you kind of want to count back from, hey, how many days is it going to take for this to mature? And that's usually listed on the seed packet or in the catalog. And then say, okay, this is when I want it ready. And that kind of gives you a good idea when to plant. But pumpkins, as long as they have a lot of space and you kind of keep weeds under control, are not that difficult to grow. And granted, there's always some things like insects and disease that can get onto them. But they're probably easier to grow than most people think. In fact, for many years, you know, we used to buy a pumpkin and then we'd throw it in our compost pile. And then all of a sudden, the seeds from those pumpkins started to germinate the following year. And I think for about 4 or 5 years, we had pumpkins that we would harvest growing out of the compost pile. And we didn't even do anything to them.
Well, what's the biggest pumpkin you've ever seen?
Well, one of the things I do, and I did not do it this year because of all the COVID stuff, but I normally go to North Carolina. And I'm actually like a certified judge for their vegetable divisions of their fair. So I do their big state fair and their national fair. And that being said, there's a lot of different divisions of vegetables that I'm judging. But one is obviously it's pumpkins and weight. And I have seen pumpkins close to 2,000 pounds that have come in. Certainly several in the 1,600 to 1,800 pound category. And this is not something, you know, you bring your entry in the back of a, you know, you're in your trunk and just carry it into the fair. No, sir. These things come in on trailers and they're lifted off. They're on pallets and lifted off with forklifts and brought into the fairs that way. So, you know, you see it all. I've seen pumpkins as small as, you know, not much bigger than a golf ball, depending on the variety. And then there's some that are just absolutely colossal. You know, you talk about Cinderella's carriage. It actually looks like Cinderella could fit in there. There are some big ones, and there's a whole technique to growing those as well. It's not just, hey, I think I'm going to you know, grow a 1,000-pound pumpkin. Those people that do it, you know, they're dedicated.
Well, if somebody wanted to grow one that size, what would you suggest they do? I mean, you know, how do you go from a regular pumpkin to 2,000 pounds?
The first thing, and absolutely probably the most important thing, is you have to select the proper variety. You know, when you're looking at the numerous catalogs, you're shopping in some of those, you know, stores that sell seed, you're going to see all different kind of pumpkin varieties. Some are better for, like, just decoration. Some are great for making jack-o'-lanterns. Some are good for eating. But if you want a true giant, you have got to pick one of those varieties. Atlantic Giant's one that comes to name. There's several of them out there. And you want to pick one that has got the, you know, genetics, the capability of reaching that size. That's the first step. Now, when you plant those pumpkins, you might plant several different hills or different plants of pumpkins. But the way you got to do this is you have to wait till they start to form a little fruit, you know, so you're getting pumpkins kind of forming up everywhere. And then you begin to pick them off to where you leave maybe one pumpkin per plant. And with that, all you can almost imagine, all the energy and the food that you feed it is going to go to that one pumpkin. So it's basically isolating it and allowing all the good stuff to go to that one pumpkin. And these things are sort of, you know, the ones that go to these state fairs, they probably sleep out there with them. You know, they're nurtured. They're fed a great diet of nutrition, watered when they need to be, grown in very good amended soils. But the key is, you know, they selected the proper genetics. And then they have got, you know, the care going to that one pumpkin so that it becomes the one that they want. And they may have several plants growing on around the site, but, you know, there's going to be one pumpkin on each one of those plants. That's the key. And then you just have to watch them, you know, really, really close all the way up till the time of harvest.
Now, you mentioned variety. I mean, there are, you know, it's not just the orange pumpkin. Do the colored pumpkins, is that done, you know, through paint and I just don't know it? Or do they actually grow in different colors based on variety?
Oh, there are so many different pumpkin varieties out there now. It's pretty amazing. Yeah, I mean, pumpkins are obviously are painted and all that stuff. But, no, there are different color. There's one called Goblin. And it is a naturally, you know, it was basically bred, but it was bred for its color. It is a green color, and it's got all these little warty-looking bumps all over it. I mean, it looks like something kind of like, you know, from a horror movie. There are pumpkins that are yellow in color. You know, they've got some different versions, striped pumpkins. So one good thing, if you want to look at it this way, pumpkins are part of a family of vegetables called the cucurbits. And the cucurbits includes everything from squash to pumpkins to cucumbers, a whole line of things. Well, they have what's called a lot of genetic variability, and that means when they start crossing, you know, what you buy in the seed store is going to be what you see. But then if you use those seeds again or they cross-pollinate, you get different versions of it, okay? They're almost doing their own hybridization, and with that, you get some pretty funky-looking stuff. And this is where a lot of new varieties come from. Sometimes they look different in shape. Sometimes it's a difference in color.
Now, are there any diseases that are exclusive to pumpkins, or just would the same diseases that affect other vegetables and gourds affect a pumpkin in the same fashion?
It's really going to be the second part of what you just said. They're going to be very susceptible to things that the cucurbits would naturally get. That would be stuff like powdery mildew, downy mildew, or a couple of fungal diseases that happen to attack the leaves of the plants. Sometimes they can get some other bacterial diseases or leaf spots. They're also going to be kind of susceptible to the same insects that would attack things like cucumbers and squash, and that would be pickle worm, squash vine borer, squash bug. So you definitely, you know, want to keep an eye on those. And the other thing is, you know, pumpkins are late season. A lot of times your regular squash are done, and your pumpkins are just beginning to form up late in the summer because you're not going to even see anything until it gets late summer, and then all of a sudden a little pumpkin starts to form up, and it's going to sit there all the way, you know, till harvest time, which could be late September, early October. And if you know anything about vegetables, late season, late summer, you know, that's when all the nasties are out there, the bugs, the disease, and things like that. So it's something you really have to keep an eye on.
Well, you mentioned that the window for Halloween to grow pumpkins is May to June. Does that hold true for Thanksgiving pumpkins as well, or do you get an extra month since you've got a month time between Halloween and Thanksgiving?
The nice thing about pumpkins, they're actually considered to be a winter squash, and there's a whole category of winter squash. People are probably familiar with acorn squash, butternut squash, and the whole likes of that. Well, pumpkin is just one of those. It's pretty much like a gourd. And that being said, it gets its name winter squash, not because we grow it in the winter, but because it will store for so long. Once you harvest it, it could store all the way through the winter. That being said, you know, even if you planted the pumpkin in a traditional time frame, late May, you know, into June, and you harvested it, and it's ready to harvest, say, September, that pumpkin could last all the way through, well, I mean, if it's taken care of, all the way to Christmas time. Or you have the alternative, you can always plant it a little bit later. You could wait to the end of June, you know, plant it, kind of take care of it, and then the harvest on that might be a little bit later. So you could do it two different ways. But the bottom line is, if it's in a good location, you know, that pumpkin can last a while.
Do you yourself plant gourds?
I actually thought you were going to say pumpkins. I have planted pumpkins this past year. Gourds, no.
And I haven't
there.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, been there, done that. I have planted gourds. I've planted birdhouse gourd and some of the other ones. And they're fun to grow, but let me tell you something. They will grow like kudzu, and they will take over. And then if you don't get all the fruit out of the garden, all the gourds, when they lay in there and, you know, kind of biodegrade in the soil, those seeds will come back again. So I planted gourds 1 year and got gourds for 4 years. So they can take over.
So, but would you say that the pumpkin may be the simplest of the gourds?
I don't necessarily would say it's the simplest. I would think, you know, some of the other gourds may be a little easier because they kind of mature quicker. And I think anytime something can mature faster, it's an advantage. It's less time, you know, for it to sit out there for the bad guys to get to. But pumpkins are not that difficult. I think the biggest issue people have with pumpkins is A, they'll either plant them too early, or they don't realize that, you know, hey, these things are going to take up a lot of space. And then all of a sudden they're like, you know, what do I do? I have to start cutting it back because it's going crazy on me. So, but, you know, pumpkins are probably in the medium range, I would say, of difficulty.
Okay, well, you know, people use pumpkins this time of the year, Halloween for decoration, and the Thanksgiving season for pies, for dishes, and for decoration. Do they have to be stored differently depending on how you intend to use them?
Yeah, certainly. You know, when you're picking pumpkins, whether it be one for you're going to cut up as a jack o' lantern, or you're going to cut it up to eat, or whatever. When you're picking pumpkins, again being a winter squash, you're basically waiting for it to completely mature. And the way you know that is the vine will normally start to kind of dwindle down. The actual what we call the handle, you know, the part that's attached to the vine on the pumpkin. It starts to get kind of dry and brown. When you cut the pumpkin, you always want to leave some handle on there. Leave 4 or 5 inches of handle because that'll help that pumpkin to actually survive longer. When I say survive, it'll store longer. But to answer your question, yeah, I mean, obviously, if you take pumpkins and stick them out in, you know, sunlight where they're going to get rained on and exposed, you know, kind of as a decoration, the lifespan on them is going to be shorter than if you said, you know, hey, I'm going to store a bunch of these eating-sized pumpkins, you know, to make several different pumpkin pies. If you keep them in the house, you know, kind of in a sort of semi-cool, dry location, they're going to store a lot longer.
Now, a lot of people like pumpkin seeds. Are they the ones that, you know, germinate from the actual pumpkin plant? Are they edible, or do they have to be treated in any way, or are they just the pumpkin seeds you see in the store?
There are probably some specific varieties that put out a little larger seed, and I'm not real familiar with them, but any pumpkin seeds that comes out of a pumpkin are essentially edible. And basically what you have to do, and there's a whole like dehydration process. Some people do it in the oven to have to dry them out. Some people salt them and all. But no, any pumpkin seed that comes out would certainly be edible. Now, are they tasty? I've never been able to eat stuff like pumpkin seeds and sunflower seeds. Now, my son could put like a whole wad of them in his mouth and somehow you know, get the nut out of there and not the shell, I'd be choking to death on them. So yeah, I don't go there.
Yeah, you and I, neither one of us share that talent. Well, now, you know, as we move into fall, and this is something you educated me on the last time you were here, the leaves are changing color. And we always assume, or at least I always did, that leaves are losing color. Actually, as you educated me last time, they are actually, it's a different process than most people think. Could you kind of go into that for the listeners that might not have heard the last time you were here, what actually causes the leaf to change color and how that process works?
Sure, yeah, and it's actually sort of a misnomer that the leaf is changing color. Now, obviously, to our eyes, you know, we're seeing these leaves green all year long, and all of a sudden we get to fall, and it's like, hey, they're changing color. They're turning yellow. They're turning brilliant orange, red. But it's not exactly what's happening. What's happening is the chlorophyll, and chlorophyll is the kind of the feeding part of a plant. It produces chlorophyll through sunlight and water and CO2 and other type things. And basically what it does, it's the plant food. It creates this green substance, which is feeding the plant, and that chlorophyll, the pigment in it, is a green color. That's what you see in the tree leaves during the growing season. So it actually is almost a camouflage, this green. When the days start to get shorter, the days start to get cooler, we're getting into fall, all of a sudden, somehow the plant signals itself that, hey, you know, we're going to shut down and go into dormancy. Chlorophyll production gets greatly reduced and finally terminates. When that happens, that green pigment basically fades away, and then what you're left with is actually the true color of the tree leaves, whether they be yellow, orange, red, or what have you. And there's additional pigments within that plant, too, that can be released that add to that color. So the bottom line is we're kind of seeing what the real color of that plant is when we hit the fall.
Well, growing up, I always lived in, and the house I grew up in was surrounded by pine trees, but now I have oaks and magnolias, and so I get an awful lot of leaves. How important is it to get them off the yard?
You know, that's always been a, yeah, I can remember as a kid, my dad raking up the leaves, make a big old pile, and then we used to jump in there. He used to get mad because what he just raked up used to get scattered to the high winds, but we had fun diving into the weed piles. And there are some folks that leave the leaves out there year-round. Other people are meticulous and you know, kind of maintenance gurus and want to get every single leaf up. But it kind of depends. If you've got sort of a natural yard of pine straw, you know, wooded area, certainly getting the leaves up is not going to be a priority. But if you're one that has a maintained turf grass, be it, you know, one of the warm season Bermudas or St. Augustine centipede or even fescue lawn, you know, cool season, if you've got a lot of leaf litter out there, it can actually be damaging to your grass. And a couple of reasons. A, it kind of shades it. You know, a lot of our grasses prefer some sunlight. And they're still, even in the, you know, as the leaves are changing color and dropping, that grass is still functioning. When all those leaves get on there as a blanket, it's actually shielding the sun from them. So they're not able to do that photosynthesis and that chlorophyll production we talked about. The other thing is if you get enough of them on there, it creates a mat. It's almost like a wet, soggy mat condition, like a blanket that's wet almost. And that can lead to problems of disease or suffocation of the grass underneath. So it's a good idea, you know, to get the leaf rake out, the blower, the lawnmower, whatever you might have, and try to at least get off some of that cover so that it doesn't harm the grass.
Especially that bottom layer. I know exactly what, when you describe that perfectly, it's that slimy layer at the very bottom of the leaf pile if you don't stay on top of it.
Exactly.
So, yeah. Now, what do you suggest people do with the leaf litter that they accumulate?
You know, one great thing to do with it, and I wish I actually had more of them, is, you know, take those bags of leaves, and if you've got the vegetable garden we just talked about, and maybe you've got, you know, the winter garden, you're not going to have much out there right now, shoot, put them out over the garden. You can just spread them out, and they'll break down, or if you'd like to run a tiller through them and till them into the soil, that's going to turn into some really good organic amendment, which will provide not only nutrition, but it's going to provide a good sort of topsoil as it breaks down. So that's an excellent way to do it. You can put them in compost piles, you know, pile them in a constructed compost bin or whatever, and allow them to break down into good, we call humus, which is a dark, earthy soil that comes from all that organic breaking down. So that's another thing. You know, it's harder and harder. Back in the day, you used to see people pile them up out in front of the curbs. And maybe Griffin, I'm not sure. You know, we'll still pick up leaves.
They
but
do.
Okay, but more and more you're seeing a lot of municipalities will not pick up what they call green litter, you know, like the leaves and branches and stuff like that, because they don't have the space. So you really got to find something to do with them. And the leaves, you know, I say they're kind of, if you treat them right, it's almost like black gold for compost or for adding good organics into your garden.
Well, I compost mine as much as I can. I have more leaves than I can actually put in the compost pile, but that, especially with the, on the side of my house, I have, it gets very little sunlight, and if you don't stay on top of it, I get that slimy, wet bottom layer. And it'll come in a hurry. I mean, you 2 or 3 days, if you get some rain, that bottom pile just looks a mess. So I try to stay on top of that. But, you know, I think just for the citizens of Griffin who may be listening or who are unaware, the city does still pick up your leaf and branches and stuff. The branches can't be any longer than 4 feet long, and the entire pile has to be 4 foot high by 8 foot long. And otherwise, the city will not pick it up. So, you know, it is, as Bob says, a good idea to stay on top of it, because you can have a pile 4x8 in no time, even with a smaller lawn if you have enough trees. But let's move into ornamentals. As the temperature gets cooler, we tend to stay inside a little bit more and can sometimes ignore our ornamentals. How important is the watering process at this time of the year? I mean, it doesn't really change, but people tend to think that because it's cooler, maybe their plants don't need as much water.
And there's actually a little bit of truth to that, but it doesn't mean they don't need any water. You know, most of the water from plants is lost through transpiration. Basically, if you want to think about the plant sweating like we sweat, it's a little bit like that. You know, the plant's absorbing water. It utilizes some of the stuff out of the water, and then it transpires, or if you want to call it, sweats it out of its leaves, particularly at nighttime. But that continues to occur even during the fall, although it slows down. With that being said, a plant's going to need water even during the fall and the winter. So it's a good idea to keep an eye on your plants, particularly ones that might be in most need of water, and then irrigate when you need to. Maybe once a week would be enough, particularly if we're getting any kind of rain in. But just because, and particularly, you know, if you're planting new plants, whether it's some bedding plants or you've maybe installed a new tree or some shrubs, those first couple of weeks are critical. That plant really needs to be what we call acclimated. And by acclimation, we mean, you know, you're giving it a little bit water each day to kind of get used to its new environment. It came from a nursery where it was probably being watered at least once, maybe twice a day. So you have to kind of wean it off of that. So that first, you know, couple of weeks on new plantings is critical to water.
Now, you bring up a good point, and this is a little bit off topic, but when you go to, say, for fall plants or what have you, and you want to look to the advice of experts, are your local nurseries generally reliable for solid information?
You know, I would say the mom and pop type nurseries, you know, where you've got, that's what they specialize in, are normally going to be fairly versed in what grows well, how big does it get, you know, does this take full sun, full shade, that type of thing. And I'm not picking on the box stores per se, but, you know, anytime you go to some of the larger box stores and they have everything from, you know, plumbing stuff to household goods to ornamentals, you're not normally getting the top expertise in those garden centers. You know, the folks may have been working over nuts and bolts one day, and then they're all of a sudden they're over in the plant section. And that's understandable. But you're better off having some knowledge when you're going in to buy plants there versus you might spend a little bit more money at the mom-and-pop type nurseries. But with that, you know, you're going to get the expertise. And so I think it's actually worth it.
Well, now, you mentioned just a moment ago about fescue and certain lawns that just are winter-based. I mean, they just grow, and they don't grow dormant like some other types of grass seedings. Is now the time to fertilize, or is that go for all grasses or all lawns? Is this the time of the year to try to have things ready for the green explosion come springtime?
That's a great question, and the answer is it depends. If it is one of the warm season grasses we talked about a little while ago, and warm season being one that thrives during the warm, hot temperatures. That's Bermuda, St. Augustine, Zoysia grass. Those type grasses are going to begin to shut down now. They're actually, I'm out, you know, looking, and I can see some of my Bermuda beginning just to slow down. It's not growing like it used to. You really want to hold off right now on fertilizing. You know, we're coming into November here within a week or so. You don't want to push any more growth at this time. You want to allow that grass just to go into its dormant state, which will happen eventually. So you want to hold off on fertilizing any warm season turf grass. Cool season turf grass, and you mentioned fescue, and that's about the only cool season grass we would have other than annual ryegrass, which is sometimes planted as a temporary cover crop, or some people will plant ryegrass into their warm season so that they have green color. That could be fertilized now. Certainly, you know, the cool season grasses, they're coming into their prime, per se, in the months of October, November. If you were going to plant fescue or any type of ryegrass we talked about, this would certainly be the time to be doing that. And, you know, the nutrition will be important on them.
Now, adding color to the landscape, I mean, you know, everybody wants the green, but at this time of the year, you know, as you say, grass starts to grow dormant. It recognizes that the days are getting shorter and the temperature's cooler. What can we do to add some fall color to our landscape?
Well, I just unloaded fall color out of my truck a little while ago, and we certainly have some coming into our landscape. My wife is huge into flower planting around here. It's like a botanical garden of flowers. And we're still seeing plenty of summer color in here. I was looking at some Mexican heather, which is still blooming brilliantly. We've got impatiens that are out there blooming. But, you know, we've got some stuff she's going to put in. And from the annual side of things, we've got a bunch of snapdragons, which are cool season annuals that do wonderful. We always plant an assortment of pansies, multicolored type pansies, that we're going to put into the landscape. Chrysanthemums, even though they'll bloom during the spring a little bit, in the summer sometimes, mums thrive and bloom best in the fall, so that's a great plant to add to your landscape. And in most cases, it'll act as a perennial, meaning it'll come back every year and does quite well. You know, I'm actually looking around my landscape as we're speaking, and I've actually got some vegetables that add color to the landscape. One thing I have is Swiss chard. Now, although it's an edible, you know, vegetable that we like to eat, I have one called Bright Light. And Bright Lights is a very colorful Swiss chard. It's almost translucent a glowing type stem to it that's bright red and kind of orangey, depending. There's all kinds of different colors in there. So it's kind of a cool thing. And speaking of vegetables, some of the ornamental cabbages that you can buy are really cool to plant in planters or around the landscape bed. They are actually edible, but they're also very, very aesthetically pleasing. So there's a number of things you can do to add some spice to the landscape this time of the year.
Will the purple cabbage grow this time of year?
Yes, it will. Any of those type cabbages or whatever, this is the perfect time to plant them.
Well, now, when it comes to the fall ornamentals and then your spring and summers, do you have to create some distance to keep them from competing for what resources and nutrients are in the ground?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think anytime you plant something, whether it be just an annual bed or whatever, you do have to think about, you know, what's the maximum size this is going to get? Am I planting somewhere it's going to compete with something else? And particularly when it comes to ornamentals, and when I say ornamentals, I'm talking about things like, you know, that are perennial, that are going to be there for a while. When you go to the nursery, we just talked about the nursery, whether it be one of the box stores or mom-and-pop nursery, all the plants, you know, if you've ever been to one, they kind of look about the same size. You know, you get your little 1 gallons and your 3 gallons, they all look kind of innocent. But what you don't realize is you better know how big those plants are going to get. Some of the plants, for instance, I'm looking at right out here, we've got some blooming knockout rose. And knockout rose is a pretty little super hybrid rose that blooms all summer long into fall. When you buy them in a little 1 gallon plant, heck, they're only about a foot tall. But our knockout roses are every bit of 5 feet tall and 6 feet wide. And if you didn't plan for that, you know, you could get them all bunched together and have issues. Same thing with crepe myrtles. You know, people buy them all the time, plant them near the house. Better make sure what variety you have. We've got crepe myrtles that get no taller than 3 or 4 feet. And then there's a plenty of varieties that will get 30, 40, 50 feet tall. So a lot of it comes down to plant knowledge, knowing what you're buying, And, hey, am I spacing it properly so that when it does get bigger, it's not going to be touching or competing?
Now, I know for a gardener such as yourself, I know the answer to this question, but because you're going to say it's never too late, but if you wanted to start a fall garden now, what would you suggest trying to grow?
It's never too late. Just figured I'd throw that out at you. As far as vegetable gardens go, if you look at some of our brochures, even, you know, we sort of say, well, your window's over. But I tell you, you can still slip stuff in so easily right now, particularly since a lot of the vegetables are already in the stores. If you want to go buy transplants, certainly if you're going to do broccoli, cauliflower, Brussels sprout, something like that, start with a transplant. You don't have time to grow your own right now. You could have done that if you did it about 8 weeks ago. But if you want to get a transplant in right now, it's probably going to produce for you. Any of the greens, such as, collards, turnips, mustard, you can get that stuff in the garden just seeded right now. It grows so fast, you'll certainly have harvest. I've got so many greens out here, I don't know what to do with them. And some of them I only planted about a week and a half ago. You know, some I planted earlier. So I think there's still plenty of time. I'm not a huge believer in the climate change thing, but at the end of the day, I swear it seems like we're getting longer and longer, extension of summer weather. I'm out here in the T-shirt right now. We're about to be in November. So, you know, if that tells you anything, I think we've got plenty of time still, you know, between now and maybe the second week of November to slip some fall garden vegetables in.
Well, not to be a conspiracy theorist, but I'm totally with you on this climate change thing. I think that our society has mistaken the terms global warming, which there has been a very slight global warming. I mean, 1 degree over the course of 20 years is considered global warming. That is not necessarily climate change. And I think too many people try to interchange the two words, and they're just not the same thing. But, okay, now we still have some summer vegetables. We were lazy in our harvesting.
Mm-hmm.
What to do with them now?
Okay. Well, and I've had this question actually a couple of times over the past few weeks. Somebody said, hey, I'm still getting peppers. Should I pull them up, you know, and plant something else? I was like, it depends on what you want to do. We're still pulling peppers. Peppers are super hardy plant, and you will pull peppers until you get that first heavy frost. Sometimes that's Thanksgiving or more. So okra, we're still pulling okra. You know, I mean, I get tired of picking it. There's so much out there. But okra keeps on coming down. You know, keeps on coming. It doesn't wait for anybody. So, yeah, if you got some summer vegetables and they're still producing and the plants look fairly healthy, go ahead and keep them going if you want to. If you want to pull them out and swap to something else, that's up to you. But the main thing is this. Once those plants have terminated or you're tired of them or they're done, there's no more producing or you're tired of picking them, go ahead and get them out of the garden. Don't just leave them in there. Because what that does, that acts almost like a hotel room for problems, a hotel room for disease or insects that will possibly overwinter and spend the winter in that old plant, which will come out next spring and cause you trouble. So get those plants either out of the garden, put them in the compost pile, let them break down, or potentially cut them down into the garden and till them in, till them up. And then maybe plant a cover crop or something like that. But the key is don't leave them just standing in there forever.
Okay, what about saving seeds from some vegetables they may be still trying to stick around? Can you save those and plant them next year? Do they need to be stored in any certain way?
Yeah, and that's one of these that it depends. In most cases, a lot of people are planting hybrid vegetables. You know, you go to buy a package of squash, package of cucumbers. Those are hybrid seed. They're seed that, you know, have been selected for the best of the attributes, and when you get that seed, you can be assured that's what you're getting, okay? The problem with it, and we mentioned this, particularly on the cucurbits, the cucumbers and squash and all those things, they're very volatile when it comes to genetics. What happens is that year you're growing them, you're getting what you see on the seed packet. However, as they're going, even though you won't see it in this generation, if this makes sense, they are cross-pollinating with other things. They're cross-pollinating with themselves, and they're not true to variety. So all that being said, when you save the seed off of most hybrid and try to replant it, you potentially will get something, but it will not be exactly the same as the parent plants. It's kind of like you and me. You know, we got some of the traits of mom and dad in us, but we're not exactly like them, so there's going to be genetic variability. However, there are... There are open pollinated vegetables, particularly what they call the heirloom type, the old ones that are not hybrid, that when you save the seed from them, those will come back true to species, if that makes sense. So there are a few things out there that can work for saving seed, but for the most part, many of the things that you see in the store or the seed packets are going to be hybrids that are not going to produce the same thing that they did the first year, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. But the cross-pollination, is that more of an issue, say, in other regions of the country? Like, I can remember the first time I ever visited the Midwest. I couldn't believe that the wind would blow that hard all the time. I mean, just unlike here in the South. You know, you would see, you know, consistent winds at 15 to 20 miles per hour, and these people treated it like it was nothing. And for us, that's a pretty brisk wind. Is that the cross-pollination, is that a little more common in other areas of the country, or is that something that the whole nation sees?
It's something the whole nation sees, and the reason is this. For the most part, and there's a lot of exceptions, I'll mention a couple here, but for the most part, plants are not pollinated from wind. They're pollinated from insects.
Okay.
And the insect has the ability to, you know, go not only from plant to plant, but from garden to garden. And for that matter, probably from neighborhood to neighborhood, you know, within a reasonable distance. So you have got insects coming in and out of blooms all day long. They're going from one vegetable to another. And with that, you're getting multiple amounts of pollen on those, whatever the insect pollinator, be it a bee or some other type of pollinator, and then they're visiting the next bloom, and so you're getting cross-pollination going on. Again, that first-generation vegetables that comes out will be true to variety, but it's the seed that are forming that have got now new genetic traits. Some cases, like corn, you've got sweet corn or whatever, any kind of corn, that is wind-pollinated, and so that wind can, you know, certainly play tricks on pollination as well. With corn, tomatoes pollinate themselves, basically. They don't need a lot of help from anything. So, you know, it really depends. But for the most part, insects are doing the pollination, and so we can have genetic variability almost anywhere in the country.
Well, in your vast gardening experience, have you had hybridization take place on your own garden where something just gets slightly modified in a way that you didn't necessarily expect?
Absolutely, particularly in terms of you know, as many times as I've planted my garden, and I try to rotate things around, you know, to try to help a little bit with disease and this and that. But sure enough, you know, there'll be a squash or something that, you know, you didn't get picked or it kind of fizzled into the garden. And all of a sudden, you got like a rogue seed germinates. And you're like, oh, where does that? And I might just let it grow. And then all of a sudden, you, boom, you got some kind of striped, funky-looking squash. Or it might be one of the winter squashes or a funky-looking cucumber. Yeah, so I see it quite often. It's kind of fun. I mean, and people say, well, you know, can I eat that? Is that edible? Yeah, it's certainly edible, and there's nothing wrong with it. You can save all the seeds you want to and plant them. Just don't expect, you know, them to be exactly what you had the first time around. But as far as, you know, edibility, and that's in a very kind of simplistic way, that's how they come up with new varieties. They let them cross-pollinate. And then, you know, as far as how they come up with a better variety, they just keep cross-pollinating and selecting the best of the best of the best, and they finally make a determination, hey, this is about as good as it gets. Let's go with this one. So in a way, it's almost like a little mini hybridization when you're doing it in your garden.
Now, here's where we're really going to need Bob Westerfield's technical expertise. If you would explain to our listeners some of the pronounced differences between a hybrid and a genetically modified vegetable.
Okay, GMOs, yeah, and that's kind of a hot button. Every time I do a vegetable talk somewhere, you know, it always pops up. What do you think about GMOs? Or aren't all these hybrid varieties out there? You know, because I start mentioning about all these better hybrid sweet corns and this and that, and they're like, oh, we don't want to plant that. That's GMO. So let's try to make this as simplistic as possible. First of all, I tell everyone right off the bat that, you know, if they've ever eaten out anywhere or, for that matter, been to the grocery store, they probably have eaten GMO vegetables. And, you know, they're still here. They haven't turned glowing or whatever, so you're probably good. If you've driven a car today and bought gasoline, you've used GMO products because that's probably got ethanol, you know, which is GMO corn normally. But all that being said, a GMO is a genetically modified organism. It's taking the attributes of one organism, which usually is non-related, and putting it into another one. An example would be, you know, we've got what's called Roundup Ready corn, you may have heard. Roundup Ready corn, Roundup is glyphosate. It's a chemical that's extremely successful in controlling almost all type weeds. They found a way to actually get a genetic trait into the corn, okay? By doing that, when they spray Roundup over the corn, it doesn't kill the corn. It only kills the weed, so it makes it kind of an easy maintenance for farmers to do. That's one way. There's BT, what's called Bacillus thuringiensis. There's BT plants like BT corn, BT soybeans. Basically what it does, it's a naturally occurring disease that's completely non-harmful to humans, but it kills caterpillars. And so they're able to basically get this organism into the seed, and then when that seed germinates, it has the ability to form its own bacillus, its own BT, that will kill caterpillars. So it's a way to kind of, you know, make it a little bit easier on gardening. So that is GMOs, genetically modified. Hybridization is what we've been talking about here for the last 30 minutes. It's when a plant crosses with another plant. Basically, you know, the plant has relations, if you will, through pollination with another plant, and then genetically it changes. So we talked about saving seed, how it can change to a, you know, a slightly different looking plant. That's hybridization. Now, on a large scale, producers, vegetables, flowers, trees, whatever, they will cross-pollinate bunches of stuff, and then they'll start looking at them and say, hey, you know, this one grew bigger, this one looked prettier, this one had better color. So then they'll start taking them and cross that with the best of the other bunch, and then they continue to do this through many, many cycles, and eventually they get, you know, where you've taken the two strongest parents, and they're producing this super offspring. Once they've got that offspring, that is the hybrid plant, the hybrid flower, hybrid vegetable. And then from there, they're able to actually save pure seed by isolating it. So they're not letting it cross-pollinate anymore. They're able to get pure seed from it, and that's where the seed comes in the store. So I know that's kind of confusing, but that's the difference. So hybridization is just using basically the same type of plant, crossing it with each other, you know, just a different one, and getting that. GMOs is using a different organism that's going to provide some beneficial attributes and introducing it into another organism. And, you know, there are people all fearful of GMOs and this and that. I mean, just personally, I'll go on record saying I'm not. I mean, we've been having them a long time. I don't think there's been any true proof of them ever hurting anyone. Where it does come into play is sometimes we talked about the GMO, like Roundup Ready corn. What we have found is when you use a product enough, like either Roundup or BT or anything else, sometimes you build up immunity to the insect population or the disease population. In other words, they begin to become complacent and it doesn't control them anymore. So we are seeing where there's resistance build up sometimes in that light from using a product over and over and over, whether it be sprayed or it's coming naturally through that plant, if that makes sense.
Yeah, well, I did a little research on my own about GMOs, one of your previous appearances, because the idea is, you know, you're actually altering the DNA, which I have no problem with. I understand that some people do. And originally, there were some studies done that maybe the thought was there that maybe it triggered allergies or even certain forms of cancer. And it turned out that the biggest test that they ever ran on cancer, they had to throw out the results because the study was so poorly done. I mean, it was almost arranged so that the results of the tests would show that GMOs were cancer-causing, and, you know, it turned out that that turned to be all false. But how can we identify a GMO?
More and more I'm seeing on labeling right now where they, and I don't, you know, you got me on that one. I don't know if it's required to list that this is a GMO, you know, grown product or whatever. Certainly, you know, if you bought something, let me just say, if you bought something like tacos or, you know, any kind of bread or something, there's a good chance you're having GMO, you know, wheat in there, this or that. I would have to look to see if it says. But what you do see sometimes, and I think it's more marketing, is you'll see the words non-GMO vegetable, non-GMO product. And I think that's more to kind of appeal to people like, oh, this one must be safer than that one, you know, just like you see the word organic on the bag sometimes. So I don't really ever seen one that this is GMO product, you know, vegetable, but I do see where it says non-GMO because it seems to appeal to people's fears that, hey, this has got to be better or safer. I'm not necessarily in that school of thought, but, you know, heck, anything that, you know, sells the products and works for them, I guess they go with.
Yeah, well, I just looked it up as you were saying that because that's kind of fascinating to me.
Yeah.
It does say here that in January of 2022, the USDA will require food manufacturers to label everything containing GMO ingredients, but the labels won't necessarily say GMO, but will instead use the term bioengineered food.
Okay, well, they're bioengineered, so that'll be the new way. And I've heard that term before, just it's not real commonplace, but that's what we'll be looking for now.
Just GMO is much simpler to say.
I think so, yeah. Even if you don't know what it means, you know what it means, so to speak. So.
Yeah, I mean, good point. Now, as far as trees, you know, and I know that you have said before that fall is a pretty good time if you're going to transplant.
Mm-hmm.
What advice do you give for people who want to do maybe have a tree and maybe have it ready for spring to really start blooming? Is now the time of year to be looking into transplants?
Well, two things. First of all, now is a great time of the year to be planting new plants, you know, trees that you may have purchased at a nursery, be it fruit trees and or ornamental trees. Now is a great time to do that. The main reason, even in the transplanting side of this question, is the top of the plant, what we call the crown, is beginning to shut down. We talked about, you know, kind of the dormant state.
Right.
And the root system itself, in Georgia, we just do not get cold enough. I don't care how cold it gets. We don't actually freeze the ground. You may see frost, but the ground's not frozen. So the root system of plants in Georgia continue to grow. And that's what we want to occur over the fall and winter months, so that by the springtime, when it starts to get hot, you know, we've got a healthy root system out there. That being said, if I was going to transplant a tree, I would actually wait just a little bit longer. You know, if it's a smaller tree you want to dig up and you have no choice, get it now. But, you know, a lot of times like, hey, you know, I want to move this plant. I would wait till we go into complete dormancy. And that would be, you know, you start looking, hey, the leaves are off the trees now. There's nothing on the, no foliage at all. That's the safest time because even though we are changing color, we're transitional, the plant is still basically feeding itself. It's still doing its, you know, chlorophyll production. You want to get all that energy back into the tree to go into that dormant state and then transplant. So I would say we're in on the brink of transplant time. I would probably say if you could wait towards about mid-November, it would be better.
So about a month out. So now would be a good time to research what type of trees might grow best on certain types of lawns or to have your soil tested by Georgia Extension Service and find out, you know, what nutrients you have and what balance you may need to add. What type of trees for the Georgia area, for our section of Georgia, tend to do the best in the transplant season, or is it just all-encompassing?
You know, that's a good question. Most of the hardwood trees around here can be transplanted fairly easily. And when I say easily, you know, that's kind of a misnomer. It depends on the size of the tree. It's always easier, not only physically, but successfully, to transplant a smaller tree. If you've got something, you know, that's got the diameter of a pencil, you know, I'm talking about the trunk of the tree, it's going to be way easier to get that to successfully survive a transplant type move than, say, something that's got the diameter, you know, that's 4 inches wide. And the main reason is because you've got so much existing root system on those larger, bigger trees that it's going to be very difficult to maintain and to capture most of that original root system. And when you start cutting off major portions of root system like that, you're really putting that tree into a stressed state. Commercially, when they get these larger trees, if you've ever seen one before, they use these giant tree spades. It's this big contraption on the back of a tractor, and it goes in and actually cuts a giant wedge of soil, which takes up roots and everything. Most people don't have that, and you know, you got a shovel, it's going to be a job to get a larger tree out and save enough roots. So focus on transplanting only smaller plants or shrubs if you can. Try to get as much of the root system as you can from the original plant. And then have your transplant site ready so that that plant doesn't have to sit out a long time out of the ground. You want to get it to the next site, hopefully that same day, and then water it in. Allow it to kind of again, we're going to acclimate it. So you're going to want to give it a little water for the next couple of days to kind of baby it.
Well, now you mentioned shovel, and that's just one of the many tools that Bob Westerfield uses on his garden. What have you winterized? Are there certain items of garden equipment, you know, particularly the gasoline-powered ones, that we probably won't need much again between now and the springtime that we can go ahead and winterize? And if so, what recommendations do you have?
Well, you made one incorrect statement that Bob Westerfield and shovel. He tries to avoid the shovel and use something that's got a gas-powered motor on it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm straight with you there.
Yeah, whenever it can be done mechanically, it's going to be done. But to answer your question, yeah, as far as hand tools go, you know, it's a good time to clean off all the dirt, mud, whatever, so that they don't rust. Maybe spray them down with a good coating of oil. The handles, you know, if wooden handles do not last very long when you keep them outside. I tend to buy the fiberglass handle tools. They last, seem like, forever. If you've got a wooden handle, I've had some before, actually spray paint them. Whatever color you want to spray paint them, they'll last much longer for the wood. On the gasoline-powered things, maybe you're done with your tiller, your lawnmower, your weed trimmer, whatever, the absolute best way to store that for the winter is to either dump all the gas out into your gas can container or just run it out using it. And when I say run it out, you know, you're going to kind of come to empty, but crank it up again and make sure all the fuel goes out of the carburetor. We talked about, you know, GMOs and ethanol fuel and all that. That stuff is terrible on small motors. And ethanol is a water-attracting substance that will bring in all kinds of nasty little things into your carburetors on your small motors. So by completely cleansing it of old fuel, you are going to be so far ahead of the game come next springtime. And what you normally see is people say, oh, yeah, maybe that works, but I'm not going to mess with it. I guarantee you about three-quarters of the motors that are left with old fuel will not crank very easily or at all come springtime, because that ethanol, it creates these little hard, I call them like oysters, but they're like these little barnacles inside the carburetor. And it doesn't take much of that to stop the fuel from flowing through there on these tiny little carbs. And with that, you're almost never going to get it cranked. Then you've got to get a new carburetor and maintenance and so forth.
How long can somebody expect? I mean, and I know this is kind of a general question, maybe too general, but what kind of lifespan can someone expect if they properly take care of their motorized equipment for the winter, winterize it, so to speak, as opposed to people who don't?
We call it disposable equipment. It's kind of like in the equipment world. And a lot of that, to answer your question, a lot of it depends on, to start with, the quality of the equipment. There's certainly differences in quality and prices. And it kind of does reflect on the price. You know, if you're buying a name brand, really high quality, top end lawnmower, chainsaw, whatever, it's going to have the ability to probably outlast some of the cheaper, you know, kind of the run of the mill, I hate to say it, but made in China type stuff. But they all are going to be short-lived if you don't take care of them. And while, you know, the expensive ones are still going to have issues, you can easily find replacement parts for them to keep them going. So that's a key right there. But all equipment's lifespan is going to be minimized or shortened if you, A, don't take care of the fuel, and also if you don't take care of the oil. These things run at tremendous RPMs. And changing the oil regularly or making sure it has enough oil is one of the keys. And along with that, you know, when you're talking about motors, there's three things that makes a motor go: fuel, fire, and air. The fuel we talked about, that's keeping clean fuel, treated fuel, or best yet, if you can find it, and that, man, it's starting to show up more, non-ethanol gasoline. It costs a little more, but I always buy it for my small motors. The fire, that's change your spark plug often. It's a cheap kind of maintenance thing, a couple of bucks, you get a spark plug, put a new one in every year, it'll pay big dividends. And then air, that's the breather. Clean the air breather frequently. A small motor runs on more air than anything else. It runs on about 16 parts air and only one part fuel. So you really want to get a lot of air in there. You know, clean the filters. If they're disposable, buy some new ones, have them in stock. You do those things, you're going to keep your stuff running forever.
So it just winterizing is so critically important to the lifespan of your motorized equipment. How much time do you spend in maintenance? You know, I know you're bound to be a tinkerer in the wintertime when the garden doesn't require quite as much attention What types of things do you look for? I'm sure you take things apart to see if there are problems. What sorts of things do you troubleshoot for?
One of the main things I want to do, because you know, we used to burn so much firewood, and now we have a pellet stove, but it was just such a pain in the neck when I go to grab a chainsaw, and I did not have my due diligence of taking care of it, and the saw blade was dull, or I was like, oh, man, I forgot to do this, forgot to do that. So I like, particularly, and even now, you know, we always have a tree down here or there. I like to have my chainsaws ready to go. They normally have no fuel in them. That way I know when I put fuel in, it'll be fresh, and I've got them sharp. Those chain blades are ready to go to start. So it's a little bit of a hassle, but I try to go through all that. My string trimmers, you know, I want to keep a fresh string on there. You've got to replace that every so often, so that's what I'm looking for. I normally will spend, and I have to make myself do it, because I got a lot of motors around here between tractors and lawnmowers and tillers and chainsaws. I just, it'll be one day I'll say, okay, this is maintenance day, and I will go through every piece of equipment. I'll run the fuel out, or I'll check spark plugs, and it is kind of Bob Westerfield maintenance day, but I'm gonna do it one day, and I'm going to knock them all out, and that's what I do. So anything that needs to be sharpened, lawnmower blade, whatever, it's going to get done that day. And then hopefully it's going to carry me through.
Now, where can people find more information on specific topics, maybe GMO, gardening, storing, what to do with seeds? Where can they find more information on some of these topics?
Sure. And even, you know, we just talked about kind of like equipment care. We've got a publication on that. The University of Georgia has got just a plethora of free publications available online. And you can always stop by your local county extension office, and if they don't have it sitting up on the wall there in a rack, they'll be happy to print you off something. Or you can go online. If you just look up UGA Extension Publications, that first hit will be where you want to go, and there'll be about the middle page, a search engine, and just put in there whatever you want, homegrown okra, or how to select, you know, and maintain garden equipment or something like that. Chances are we've got a publication on it that should give you the ins and outs of how to, you know, take care of things, how to select plants, and how to keep it going.
Well, Bob, we are just about out of time. Our guest today on the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News has been Bob Westerfield, Extension Horticulturalist and Coordinator. Are you getting to your slow time of year? I know COVID's had a massive impact, but on your lecture tour, so to speak.
It really has. Actually, this whole year has been kind of crazy. I normally would have been going, you know, running all over the place to give talks, and now there's been a lot of virtual talks, and they're starting to trickle in now for early spring. So, you know, we would normally be doing a bunch in January, February, March. We're getting some requests now for virtual programs. It's a whole different ballgame, and if anybody knows me, I don't like virtual talks so much. I like to be in person. But yeah, it's kind of slowed down a little bit right now, but it's gearing up for early next year.
And then you've been doing a lot more radio appearances, not just here, but across the state.
Yes, sir. I always love doing radio, and like I said, you've heard it before, I've got the face for radio, so that's what we like to do.
Well, Bob, we very much appreciate your time, and you're going to be back with us, I understand, next week, and we'll be live in studio, so we'll pick out some more topics and try to help people get ready for winter and then the approaching spring from within the world of gardening.
Yes, sir. Look forward to it.
Bob, thank you very much.
No problem. I enjoyed it.
Always a pleasure to have Bob Westerfield on with us. This has been this week's installment of the University of Georgia Griffin Campus News. We hope that you'll join us next Thursday with Bob Westerfield, and we'll bring you that program next Thursday morning at 9 o'clock.